Welcome to the Polygamer Podcast, where gaming is for everyone. Join us as we expand the boundaries of the gaming community.
Hello and welcome to Polygamer episode number 51 for Wednesday, September 14th, 2016. I'm your host, Ken Gagne, and today I'm speaking with my friend Ben Chica. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for having me on your show. We, in the interest of full disclosure, are friends. We've been over to each other's houses for dinner. We don't live that far apart.
I was lectured, as Ken just mentioned, he was on my show, which we'll probably talk about briefly, but I was lectured for calling him friend of the show and not just friend, period, when we talked after PAX East. So yes, so we are friends.
Did I lecture you?
I don't know if you're at the last day of PAX East when we were both dead tired and we did our little recap of PAX. You said, I was introducing you and I said, and joining me is podcast alum and friend of the show. And you kind of jokingly were like, well, you could just drop of the show and call me friend, Ben. And it was tongue in cheek, giving me a hard time.
But I'm sorry. Oh, well, you are a friend and you are also a friend of the show. I'm glad to finally have you on Polygamer since I've been on TheoNerd twice. But let's talk about what TheoNerd is. You are a podcaster just like me. You are a co-host unlike me. You actually share the mic with somebody. So tell me about what is TheoNerd.
Sure. So TheoNerd is one, a name that we were shocked was available for the URL. So me and my co-host Andrew Tripp are just pretty straightforward theologians and huge nerds. He just finished his PhD. I'm hoping to complete my PhD this year. We're both trained in philosophy and theology. And he is what is called a practical theologian. He studies, his work is more studying congregations and on the ground kind of lived religion. And mine is more kind of conceptual. Specifically, I study science and religion. So I kind of am more abstract idea person. So between the two of us, it's a nice balance. And I've loved video games my whole life. He enjoys them, but is much more a comic book fan. And recently, with the boom of superhero movies, he is much more up to date on all of the movies that have been going on. And we've both kind of found a little mix of, it's not like every single game is relevant to our philosophical and theological interests or every comic, but there have been a lot of themes that just kind of like, ooh, this game really like, it just treats this theme interesting. And I think it has religious relevance, or it makes a good theological point, whether it meant to or not, or religion is really depicted in a very interesting way in this comic book. So the two of us had been talking about kind of treating our hobby in a more serious way for a while. And then the event that basically led to the creation of TheoNerd was all of the unfortunate Gamergate harassment towards women in gaming and the death threats they got. And it just so happened that part of my science and religion doctoral program was working in a neuroscience lab that had just studied Facebook and Twitter and how your brain reacts to it. And shock of all shocks, your brain reacts very similar to it does to in-person interactions. So if you're terrible to somebody online or great to them online, your brain, in terms of chemicals released and how it makes you, the person on the receiving end, feel, reacts the same way. So we had a panel at PAX East 2015 about the science of online bullying, and it was called The Science of Online Bullying, A Lesson in Diversity. So I talked about some neuroscience that kind of just put some data behind the very, the kind of the common phrase of, oh, it's not just the internet. Well, it's really not, that we have data to prove it. And Andrew talked about why diversity matters in the wake of that. And it was well attended. We had several hundred people show up. So at that point, the two streams converged and we said, well, we've been talking about kind of taking this more seriously for a while. We had a panel at PAX and people responded. So let's buy the URL. Let's set up a podcast and let's do this. So we did it.
And that is your rise to fame in a nutshell.
Yes, the fame. Yeah, tons and tons of fame. It's, it's kind of just our little corner of video game slash comic and superhero podcasts, our little corner that we've made for ourselves, where, I mean, we're not, there's huge podcasts that are listened to by tons of people that just cover, hey, what you been playing? What games are coming out? Are they good or they bad? Like, we don't need to try and like take over that spot. One, it's not going to happen because they're all so well established and entrenched. And we have this little kind of religion, philosophy, and games thing going on. And the people who kind of get that triangle and the diagram and how they can intersect seem to be enjoying it. And we love talking about it. So yeah, we're not the biggest thing in the world, but it's a conversation that didn't seem to be happening all over the place. So we thought we could fill that void.
Excellent. So there is a lot of stuff I want to unpack here and clarify for our listeners. One thing we will not be discussing too in depth is the neuroscience of bullying, because you did a great interview with Aline Sims on her podcast, Lesson or Equal, episode number 34, just after PAX East 2015, where you went into that topic in depth. If people want to learn more about that, there will be a link to that episode in the show notes. I highly recommend it. Sound good?
It sounds great. And I also, Aline, as somebody who, so Andrew and I interview, sometimes it's just the two of us, but a lot of times we try and get guests on just like you do with this show. And as somebody who's started doing that, Aline is a fantastic interviewer. So go listen to her interview, people, because she does a great job.
I agree. Let's start at the beginning. You said that you and your co-host are both trained in theology and philosophy. Is that correct?
Yeah, our degrees are both in theology, but the kind of sphere of theology that we work in, we could teach in some philosophy departments as well. I mean, half of my dissertation is about American pragmatism, which is a school of philosophy. So yeah, we're academic philosophy and theology.
So theology is not just religion. It's traditionally considered specifically Christianity. Is that correct?
I guess traditionally there is... There's something to the tradition that there's the canon, so to speak. So even though modern theologians are very critical of a lot of big names that people might know, like Thomas Aquinas or Augustine and philosophers that were also kind of Christian theologians like René Descartes or even Immanuel Kant, who was not a theologian but was sympathetic to religion. Anyway, people need to know that kind of the tradition, like the big names from Greek times to kind of Roman era, and they kind of established Christianity in the West for better and often for worse. But theology nowadays, in my program, in my master's program, my advisor was a Confucian Christian and was known for comparative theology. So there are Confucian theologians at the school of Boston University, where I got my master's, where I'm doing my PhD in Claremont, California. You have Buddhists, and it's a much more diverse, interdisciplinary, and interreligious enterprise in 2016 than it was hundreds of years ago, and even than it was 30 years ago. But there is something to the fact that if you're in a theology program, you definitely get old, dead white guys who talked about Christianity explicitly, but that's not necessarily what people are up to nowadays.
So you're a young white guy studying the philosophies of old white guys.
In the sense that so hopefully when I finish this dissertation this year, any position I get is going to be a junior faculty position, and I will be most likely asked to teach some introductory courses. And it is important to know the history, know the tradition, know that, like I said, for better and also for worse, these figures kind of established intellectually what Christianity became, and also politically and socially created institutions that impacted the world and impacted what Christianity became. And a lot of, as I say, a lot of modern theologians kind of reject a lot of their philosophy, reject a lot of the problematic aspects of the social institutions they created, where women were excluded and other cultures were colonized and taken over. But it's important to know what you're rejecting rather than just say, well, it was obviously problematic, so let's just get over it. It's still worth knowing what was problematic instead of just assuming. So that's kind of a practice that I think every student should go through. So that's kind of why everybody still learns the canon, the tradition, so to speak.
So kind of like Anita Sarkeesian says that we can enjoy popular culture while still being critical of it, you feel that there are elements of a particular philosophy or theology or religion that can be problematic, and it is important to acknowledge that and address it as opposed to just dismissing the entire school to which it belongs.
Well, definitely, because otherwise you're just kind of, eventually, you don't even know what you're rejecting anymore. You've just kind of, well, my teacher rejected it, and their teacher before them rejected it, and eventually nobody knows why. And I think constructive work is much better when you're engaging with the thing that you're rejecting for the alternative that you're proposing. Like, why we need to get over this certain model of God that was kind of built on political, problematic political notions, bad philosophy, rather than just saying, oh, let's not have anything to do with that. You need to know why it became dominant in the first place. Yeah, it's important. It makes the constructive work much, much better because it's actually a reaction to something instead of just an assumption that everybody goes along with.
But it can be hard to separate that history and that tradition from the current state of the organizing body behind the religion. For example, the Roman Catholic Church has not always been very supportive of particular genders or sexual orientations, especially when it comes to participation in the religious hierarchy. So people who belong to those marginalized demographics may find it easier to dismiss the entire religion because it does not embrace them. But that one particular opinion or perspective that the church holds, you're saying, is not a reason to reject the entire religion.
Yeah, I guess I'll give you an example with the current political climate. I'm not going to endorse anybody, but just an example of something that's happening right now. So there's a bunch of liberation theologians, and liberation theology came out of the global South, and it was basically theology by and on the behalf of marginalized peoples. And a lot of it is very, it's socially liberal and progressive. It's kind of, let's establish policies and create reforms to help these historically marginalized people find a better place in the world and just have better lives. And then it has theology that supports why that's a good thing to be done. But rather than kind of, we'll say, without getting too much in the history of it for listeners that don't know all this, a very kind of traditional white liberal Protestant Christianity, which can vary just easily. And let's get over the old concepts and institutions and just do this different thing instead. Liberation theology. And in wake of a lot of incidents between African-American communities and police officers in this country, have been having this very socially progressive agenda, but doing it through very gospel-oriented, charismatic, kind of traditional-looking Christian movements, Christian services on Sunday, gatherings at city halls, kind of protests in the streets. If you just looked at how it appears, the aesthetics of this, of the events they're putting on, you would say it looks like the conservative Christianity that I want nothing to do with as this marginalized person who was hurt by that. But what they're actually doing is recovering, saying, actually, in this kind of like good time religion, there were the resources all along to liberate these historically marginalized people. And what I respect about that is, with the example of the Catholic Church that you mentioned, there are liberal Catholic theologians that are currently, some of them get in trouble with the Vatican and some just get ignored, but they're trying to, from within, say, instead of just getting rid of all this, let's realize or try and reveal to you that the resources were in the tradition all along. We just need to deflect it or re-understand it or bring up lines of thought that had been neglected and show, oh, like we really should be supporting women priests. We should be supporting LGBTQ individuals. And it's hard work because they're trying to play to an audience that historically and still currently doesn't always want to hear that. But it has a better chance at actually changing institutions than just somebody who says, just get over it, change everything, and let's just do this other religious thing over here. Let's all just be super duper liberal. Well, you need to get over your prejudices. That tends to fall on deaf ears versus having a kind of more sympathetic change from the inside.
Okay, I can see that. Thank you for explaining that. I appreciate it. There's a lot more we could talk about regarding religion, but I want to tie this back into the topic of Polygamer, which is all about video games. You said you've covered video games in TheoNerd because you find it interesting how they may be representing or manifesting certain theological or philosophical principles. Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, so as I said, it ranges from philosophy to theology, and it's not always an explicit theological concept. So a few examples I was thinking of before we started recording was I read a lot of philosophy of science because of my degree is the relationship between science and religion. And Soma, the recent horror game, was a fantastic exploration of some current theories of consciousness and how consciousness could survive without a body. And like, could there be something that you could call eternal life or life after consciousness after the body that we could live on? And not even in a religious term, eternal life, just people playing with notions of consciousness that could live post the death of the rest of our body. And Soma did a fantastic job of exploring some actual alternatives that philosophers are debating right now. A lot of what Andrew and I have been interested in is games that kind of support agendas is not the right word, but kind of just have a similar social outlook, maybe. So we're both religious pluralists. We're also kind of social everything pluralists. We just need more of everything. So we've both been promoting LGBTQ rights. We want more religious pluralism in the country. Understanding more religions where kind of a certain notion of Christianity is the dominant notion of religion. So games like Gone Home or games like Life is Strange, where gamers maybe get to enter into a life and a perspective and a way of living that they may not always get to experience as, in our cases, two straight cis white guys. We just enjoy those games because we similarly want to see more of that in the world. And those games are promoting more of that in gaming, where that is not always present. So it's not always that we think a game has a great theological point. It's kind of, as theologians, we've come to some conclusion, or as philosophers, a conclusion that the world needs more of this. And then we see games also saying, the world needs more of this. And we enjoy kind of crossing those streams and just how they agree. Yes, we need more of this. Let's talk about how this game does it.
Do you think games with those messages are doing so intentionally, or are you sort of applying your own perspective when you see that in a game?
I think it's a bit of both, because I've noticed, tell me if you've noticed differently, but I feel like there have been more LGBTQ characters in games that are widely talked about in the past 5 years compared to years before that. But I also don't think, I've heard Steve Gaynor from the Fulbright Company who made Gone Home, I've heard him talk about how the game was not, it was not a gay rights game. It just happened, so happened that one of the characters was gay, and lots of people really latched on to that part of the story in the game, and it became very meaningful for them. But I think that's one of the things I like about Gone Home specifically, because rather than creating, so this is me saying that games not only are doing more of this, but also doing a better job, rather than creating a gay character and then saying, hey, look over here, we made a gay character. Look, this character's gay. Or look, we have a transgender character. Everybody look over here, this character's transgender. It was just a character in the game, and it just so happened that, like, that's who they are. and it did not shine a spotlight on it as if the creator was saying, look at us, look what we did, we included this in the game. It was just naturally revealed, and this is just who they are. We don't need to put a bright spotlight on it, and I think that's a big step forward. So it's probably a bit of me getting excited about something that I want to see more of anyway, but I also think that's maybe a good thing if it's not being done intentionally, because then the characters come off as more natural rather than forced.
But at the same time, if we're not putting the spotlight on them, then they're not necessarily taking center stage. I mean, a lot of these characters are supporting characters. Like, there is actually a Wikipedia entry for LGBT characters in video games, and it breaks it down by year. And I see very few main characters listed on here. It's usually secondary or supporting characters. The one exception I can think of is Life is Strange, where the two characters are ambiguous, and it depends on how the players make decisions as they're playing the game. Gone Home, obviously, is a major exception, because that was central to the plot. So when you say there are more LGBT characters in the last 5 years or so, I would agree with that. I think that is just the natural progression of things, but I'm wondering if it's too little, or if it's too slow.
Perhaps. I'm hesitant to say whether it's too little or too slow, because something I've been learning as I've been trying to get more involved just in the video game scene, and especially around Boston, and just try and go to more events, speak to more people, is that initially it was really easy for me to show up to events, and I was like, well, I have a PhD, or I'm about to have a PhD. I'm supposed to be a sort of expert or something. I need to have an opinion about these things and say something. And then I took a step back and was saying, well, no, I mean, my PhD in theology and science and their interaction, it's not a relevant credential to the video game world. Like, what on earth does that matter to people who make and talk about video games? So what is relevant is if I actually have an interesting idea or angle on this that they've not thought about before. So I started quieting down, basically, and listening more. And I've heard divergent opinions from basically, yes, we need more, because still, like, raw percentages, characters are basically still straight white guys in video games. But I've also heard that people who are not cis white guys have enjoyed not having spotlights shown on their characters, as if it was like tokenism. Like, ooh, look, they're in the game. Aren't we clever for doing that? So I don't have an answer one way or the other than those. That's the tension I see. And the best I can do is to raise that tension up and say it's probably a little bit of both that we need more of.
You know, when I think about mainstream media and gay characters, I often think about Brokeback Mountain, which was very mainstream, very advertised, very controversial, starred some big names as gay main characters. Do we have a video game like Brokeback Mountain, or do we need one?
I don't think we have one. Life is Strange, maybe just because it's recent, that's what I'm thinking of, but Life is Strange might be the closest thing to that. But then things are, as you say, much more ambiguous there. It depends on how you play and what you explore, what you actually learn. It could be, yes, I think it would certainly be good if unapologetically, it's just these are the main characters, or the main character, they're gay. And outside of RPGs, like BioWare's, where you can go that route if you want to, but it's all up to the player whether or not they do that with all of your romancing options in games like Mass Effect and Dragon Age. I think it would be a sort of a statement, and it would do something if there were more games like that. But I also would want to keep seeing, now that I mentioned Mass Effect, scenarios like near the end of Mass Effect 2, I want to say. I'm forgetting the crewman's name, but you can just be walking around the Citadel and completely not, like, there's no mission involved. You're just, you know, chatting with people and, you know, pressing a button. And he's up against the railing, and you initiate a conversation. It's like, oh, you look sad. What's going on? And he says, well, my husband just died in the explosion on that planet that we just escaped from. And he kind of has a very, like, he's sad and he's very honest about why he's sad. And Shepard kind of consoles him as best Shepard can. But I would still want moments like that where it's just, oh, like very nonchalantly, the game was like, this man is gay. He was married. His partner is dead now. And he's incredibly sad because they had a real genuine love for each other. And that was a really fantastic moment. And I think it's moments like that that I've heard people talk about where they really loved when LGBTQ characters were not tokens in the game. Like, that was just a very honest portrayal of this gay man was in love. His partner is dead. There is real sadness. So I think it would certainly be fascinating to see some like big, huge budget AAA game with LGBTQ lead, but I would still want those smaller non-spotlight moments because I find them so touching and special in their own way.
So there haven't been a lot of video games with as many gay characters as there are in other media. For example, I can very easily name many movies and TV shows that have gay main characters. It's hard to do that with video games, as evidenced by this discussion. And yet, in one of your blog posts, you wrote that video games tend to be ahead of the curve in addressing social issues. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, so I think you're probably referencing, I had two write-ups after PAX East this year about my experience kind of being there, and I took my recorder along with me and got some interviews and kind of covered PAX for the first time ever. So I think that's what you're talking about. And it's more, I was impressed by the open, candid conversation. So just like the rest of society, video games can do better. And I've heard various talks at events that I've gone to about just, raw numbers. We still need more women working in the video game industry, both covering it as journalists and making the games. There needs to be more protection for transgender people employed in the game industry. So just raw percentages, there's still lots of work to be done. But I was impressed by the open, very aware conversations that went on. So what I'm thinking of is the fact that at PAX East, you have things like Press XY usually having one or two, usually two in my experience, but at least one panel a year about transgender issues in gaming, lots of panels about women in gaming. And I'm just thinking about random anecdotes that impressed this upon me. And one was a transgender woman kind of being choked up briefly because she doesn't, she started getting choked up and she said just something like, I'm sorry, I don't openly talk about this all that much, about like just problems and, difficulties with her experience of how she's treated. And basically the whole crowd just started clapping and cheering wildly and supportive. And that's not common in my experience in, in the academy where, officially, schools have policies in place, and yes, they're protective of LGBTQ individuals, there's centers and there's resources, but it's kind of more cold and calculated. And just like, obviously we have policies in place. These will help people. Whereas at PAX, it's more from the heart and it was very warm and loving in a way that, in my experience in the academy and religion, people are officially on most people, I will not, it's definitely still an issue. Not all schools and not even all faculty are on board with supportive policies, but it's much more cold, calculated kind of course, yes, we support them, but it's kind of, the heart is not there. It's all like, why is this transgender student having issues? We have policies in place. Well, maybe because the heart is missing, but the heart was there at PAX East when the crowd cheered for transgender women talking about their experiences in gaming, or when the awareness angle was a fascinating exchange between a gay black man and a straight white woman, both exchanging kind of awareness of, well, as a black man, I have a certain amount of privilege over you because even though I'm gay, I'm still a man, and like men have a certain privilege over women in this country. And she said, yes, and we have problems, but I'm white and straight, and you're black and gay, so there's like a certain amount of privilege that I have over you. And that non-black and white, more nuanced conversation was eye-opening for me, because especially in news media today, it's very black and white. Like, are you privileged? Are you not? Well, like, I'm not. Like, it's a mix, and we all do good and bad jobs of acknowledging it. But I was blown away that exchanges like that happened at PAX. So that's what I meant by being ahead of the curve, in that it's much more aware from what I saw, and much more from like the heart and from a real place of wanting to make a change, rather than just a kind of cold, calculated, like, well, I guess we need to create some laws and pass some policies. But laws and policies aren't going to change the minds of people who don't care otherwise. They'll comply with the law, but they might, you know, still secretly hate anybody who's gay. So that's what I meant by ahead of the curve, if that answers your question.
No, that's true. I have seen some organizations that are just inflexible and unwilling to accommodate. I'm thinking specifically of the University of Chicago, which recently sent a letter to incoming freshmen saying that they do not support either trigger warnings or safe spaces, which I was really disappointed to hear. There is a podcast called Common Ground, which I will link to. It's all about inclusion and diversity in academia. It's run at Emerson College in Boston, Massachusetts. And their latest episode, episode number 8, addressed the question, aren't trigger warnings and safe spaces just coddling students? Isn't it shielding them from difficult subjects and conversations and disagreement? And I think that question stems from a misunderstanding of what trigger warnings and safe spaces even are.
That's another interesting topic. So just the same way that I think, my experience at PAX made me appreciate the nuance that these conversations, the way they occur in video games. The trigger warning thing, the academy needs to be completely free and open, and like, you need to learn about whatever. The professors need to have the freedom to research their subject without restrictions from the university. As a theologian, I really strongly disagree with institutions that these are usually independent, not associated with a larger university, but graduate seminaries that require their professors to sign statements of faith saying that they uphold like X, Y, and Z claims. I find those terrible because it limits freedom of research. But at the same time, I don't think denying trigger warnings and safe spaces necessarily follows from the need for freedom, because isn't understanding those part of free and open research? And that in meaning, if a school or a professor wants to not use trigger warnings or not have safe spaces, they're kind of self-limiting their own research and violating the own principle with which they want to ignore trigger warnings or not create safe spaces. Does that make sense? I'm speaking in circles a little bit, but if you're really interested in learning, you should learn about why trigger warnings matter to some people. And then once you've learned that, maybe you actually see why they're needed, rather than just shutting them down without even considering them.
No, I agree. I think that letter from the University of Chicago, I'm shocked that it got past whatever passes for their diversity committee, because they must have somebody thinking about this. Any organization with more than a few hundred employees, and ideally smaller than that, should have somebody who either part-time or full-time is thinking about this. So I was shocked that the University of Chicago did that. However, I am curious. So you're right that PAX has done, in my opinion, a good job with what some critics might say are touchy-feely topics, that there are a lot of panels about those, and I think that's a good thing. I have been to other conferences on subjects such as healthcare or classic computers, and I've never seen those topics come up. The only other convention where I've seen issues of diversity and inclusion addressed was at a storytelling conference, which maybe not as a surprise, because video games are also a form of storytelling. But I'm wondering if the reason we don't see these being addressed in other areas, and the reason we do see them being addressed in video games, is because they need to be addressed in video games more often, because these are problems that we are having that other places are not. What do you think about that?
So I think the big difference, and it cannot be ignored, is that Gamergate happened. Women in the video game industry had their lives threatened and had very disturbing personal information. Disturbing in that their personal information was found online and posted online and leaked. That happened, and people who don't think that's a problem are still out there and still making their voices heard. And it doesn't matter if they're a minority, it is still happening to this day. It happened with Ghostbusters and Leslie Jones recently. So it's not exclusive to gaming, but there is, there's a sense that it does make it a little more pressing for gaming, maybe. The Catholic Church really needs to get over the problems with women priests and just let women be priests. But to my knowledge, nobody is actively sending death threats to women who are trying to become priests. There's lots of angry political speech, but nobody is threatening their lives because they're promoting that. So it does make it a little more pressing, perhaps, that these conversations happen in the video game world. But I guess my hope is that video games can take the charge in society that way, because, well, we need to have these discussions because people's lives matter, and we got to talk about it because this has happened. So, but maybe in being forced to address it, it can be a model for other sectors of society and religious groups, political groups. Maybe that could be a fringe benefit of being forced into the conversation by unfortunate events.
So even though we may be seen by outsiders as an example of things that are wrong, like sexism and racism, maybe we can also take advantage of that spotlight and become an example for how to fix those problems as well.
Well, yeah. I had a wonderful conversation with Susan Arndt at PAX East, and she gave a great reminder that, we have these conversations because, the events happen. So we need to talk about women in gaming because women have been threatened recently. But you know what? Most gamers are awesome. And the only problem with the perception of gaming being this awful, terrible place is that we're actually talking about it. The movie industry, women are still not paid as much as men in the movie industry. Huge superstars, men still make like four or five times as much, even amongst huge, massive names that you could list off. But they're not really talking about it at the same pace. So in talking about it, the video game industry shines a light on itself, and people will say, oh man, video game industry looks really bad. Well, it looks really bad because a bunch of really good people are having this conversation and trying to make things better when a small minority is acting. But because they're actually willing to have the conversation instead of pretending like everything's okay, it looks bad because you're talking about problems. Whereas other industries still aren't highlighting the critical voices, or everybody's kind of pretending like it's okay. So I don't, in that sense, it's not necessarily a bad thing if people have this perception that video games are terrible, because we're willing to have the conversation.
We've talked about some of the parallels between video games and religion. We've talked about how you can find religious, theological, or philosophical threads and narratives in video games. What about going the other direction? Video games have these issues, these problems, these opportunities, and can video games look to theology for guidance or solutions, or should it?
Well, I was going to go two ways with that. I guess the first way, I'll start with a little plug for Boston Game Loop that you and I have both been at before, which is a small unconference or open conference, as it's often called, in Boston, where topics are not chosen beforehand. Everybody just shows up the day of and meets people and finds out what everybody's interested in. And then there's a big session where everybody's in the same room and people pitch session ideas. And then the conference schedule is formed that morning. And it just happened a week ago, it was. And I had a talk about depictions of religion in games, how to get religion right and wrong in them. Some of the best examples that we came up with in that session were things like, well, the games were Final Fantasy X was a big one. We talked about Bioshock 1 and Infinite particularly. We talked about RPGs in general and kind of the Dungeons and Dragons legacy. But there's something about a sympathetic understanding of the kind of the themes or the story of, we'll say, Christianity, specifically in the Final Fantasy X example, where you could not believe in God. You could not believe anything about claims about Jesus of Nazareth. But there's something about the story that is the problems of the world cannot be overcome by ordinary means. The people expected, in the case of Jesus, this political ruler that would just dominate the world and in a very warlike fashion kind of destroy all the bad guys on behalf of us, the obvious good guys. And Jesus kind of overturned that and said, actually, I'm not interested in war at all. And actually, the people you wanted to destroy, they're the ones I'm more concerned about. You should care more about them. And Final Fantasy's narrative, with a completely made-up religion in the video game, tells a very sympathetic story to those. It's very sympathetic to those themes. And it seems to have, I don't know this for sure, I've not spoken with the writers of the game, but its story works so well for me because it seems to have a sympathetic understanding of those themes where Titus in the game has to kind of undercut everybody's expectations about how they're going to defeat the big bad guy in the game, Sin, which is also, it's funny that they named it Sin in that game with the religious themes of it. But that's one way I think that just in terms of video games creating compelling stories, there's things that can be learned from religious narratives because there's a reason they've been around for so long. People find them compelling and are still drawn to them. And you don't have to buy it hook, line, and sinker to see that at the very like base level, it's an interesting story. And I should maybe try and understand that if I want to tell stories in video games. So I'm a big proponent of Final Fantasy X as one of the better video game stories for those reasons. I'm not sure if that's where you wanted to go with that question, but that's the first thing that came to my mind.
Well, it does bring up a good question because I've talked to other people on the show, including our mutual friend Khadija Marenkov, about cultural appropriation. And I'm wondering how that applies to religion, for example. Religion is so rich in, and I don't mean this word dismissively, myth and narrative, that it seems like it would be ripe for interpretation and reinterpretation and inspiration in video games. But at the same time, you want to be respectful of the source material and not take things out of context. So how can a game designer look to religion for inspiration when creating a narrative or a setting or an environment or a character? I know that neither of us are game designers, so this might be a little bit beyond our ken, but we can at least maybe spitball about it.
Yeah, I have two examples immediately come to mind, like a kind of how to do things and how not to do things. And it's not necessarily, like, I find Final Fantasy X to be kind of a sympathetic understanding of religion, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be approving of religion. Bioshock 1 and Bioshock Infinite kind of are very critical of Western Christianity in the game in different ways. Bioshock 1 is basically about objectivism and Ayn Rand, and without going into a deep talk about what objectivism is as a philosophy, it's basically I get mine and that's all that matters. And there are some politicians in the United States today that actually still cite her as an example. That's quite funny that they're also very upfront about being Christian, while Ayn Rand despised Christianity. But as an objectivist, she saw it as a tool that could be used to get her own ends, which is all that is true in the end. All that matters is that she gets what she wants. And in Bioshock 1, they play with what could be the outcome of that. So you'll hear splicers in the games. I think they're singing Jesus Loves Me and other kind of like children's Sunday school nursery rhymes. And it's kind of a chilling example of how problematic uses of Christianity can be used to devastating ends, where this is, you know, rapture was destroyed, but the people who rose to power still got what they want when in rising to power. Similarly, in Bioshock Infinite, very much touching upon political themes, it's the game is just dripping with Americana and people expecting a messiah. You get baptized at the beginning of the game, but then the messiah, it turns out, is going to start a war, kill entire groups of people, and then just save one select group. So fantastic commentary about problems with nationalism combined with messianic expectations. It could be allegory to a nuclear bomb problems. Very critical of Christianity, but fascinating because it very clearly understood politics and religion and how they can mix. And it both those games gave bad examples of how they can mix, but they did it really well. A bad example, I think it's not going to be religion to most people when I say it, but the God of War series, the Greek philosophy is infused in Western Christianity. People are still trying to get over it and disentangle it, but like Greek philosophy and the myths are still present in Christianity to this day. The problem with the God of War series was they turned these amazing stories about these gods and the struggles they go through that were lessons about life and what it means and what struggle is all about, and just turned them into angry things that Kratos also needs to kill because Kratos is angry. And it's one problematic because Kratos could have had so many more reasons to kill all the gods if they actually drew out the real myths and the stories about these people, because the Greek gods, they play and mess around with people all the time. That's why Jason and the Argonauts is kind of on the warpath, because the gods have been messing with him so much. But instead, the gods are all just angry. Kratos angry. Kratos kills the gods. Everybody's just angry and killing. It's also problematic because Greek people are still alive today and their culture is still very vibrant. And Greek philosophy is still alive today. And that can be a source of cultural and national pride and importance. And just getting them barely factual in the sense that you meet Icarus in the game and he's flying and then he loses his wings and then we're technically correct. This one Greek god, he flew too high and his wings got burnt. But then we just made him an angry thing killed by an angry thing. That's what comes to mind about what you say about cultural appropriation and kind of getting it wrong. But conversely, what came to mind was getting it right was critical of religion. But I think the Bioshock games actually really understood the religion they were criticizing.
Well, the God of War series is problematic, not just for the reasons you mentioned, but because when all the characters are angry and so many of them are male, especially the main character, that is an example of toxic masculinity, which we have enough of in not only our society, but in video games.
Yeah, sure. I mean, toxic masculinity, and just I could see somebody saying my example doesn't it's not correct in that God of War actually did exactly what it meant to do, which was create a 10-year-old male boy's power fantasy of, look, here's a bunch of gods and you're going to kill them all and you're going to kill them in a really bloody way. And in that sense, it succeeded. Well, I still say not really, because if God of War was going to, look, God of War was going to be this third person action game. It was going to be bloody and it was just going to be nonstop action. That's fine. That's what that's the game they wanted to make. It could have been so much more interesting. And even though, like, let's say they don't care about the story, they just want the action to be satisfying. The action would have been way more satisfying if they would have dove in deeper into the Greek myths, because you would have had way more reasons to be killing all these gods other than I'm mad as Kratos because of this one thing that the gods did to me in the past. The gods are actually way, way, way more manipulative and conniving in the Greek myths than they are in the God of War series. And there could have been a much better story that you as the player as Kratos really would have had reasons to be angry at the gods and fight them. So even on its own, taking it for what it is, it's just this kind of power fantasy and action game kill stuff. All of that action would have been way more satisfying if they actually understood those myths at a deeper level and presented it in the game. I still hold that up as a failure on various levels.
I do see a slight difference, though, where the Greek mythology is definitely part of Greek culture, but correct me if I'm wrong, as far as I know, it's not an actively believed or practiced religion per se nowadays, whereas there are a lot that are, like Christianity, Islam, etc.
Sure. I kind of brought it up as kind of the... part of your question was cultural competency. It's not a lived religion, but there is a kind of lack of cultural competency, if you will, with the way God of War presents the Greek myths, was my point.
Okay. We're running a little bit long. I want to move on to another topic, which was that in, I think, one of your blog posts, or maybe it was Less Than or Equal, I forget, you proposed that Gone Home could be taught in schools, perhaps in the context of how video games can be used to encourage empathy in the players. I think you attended my PAX East 2015 panel about empathy and narrative in indie games.
I was there.
Great. Yeah, I don't think we had met yet, so I apologize if I didn't greet you afterward, but I was so excited to have people in the audience, and I was especially glad to find out later that you were one of them. We talked in that panel about some games such as Always Sometimes Monsters, or Gone, which was the first episode of my IndieCider podcast, or Ninja Pizza Girl, or This War of Mine, which was also on IndieCider. If you were constructing a curriculum, you choose the level, grade school, high school, college, and it was looking at games like this, or it was teaching empathy, what sort of video games, or which specific video games, would you include in that syllabus?
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned This War of Mine, because that would be another great one to include. And I've probably mentioned Gone Home on just about everything I've been on. So I've mentioned it on Theo Nerd. I definitely talked about it on Less Than or Equal. I probably mentioned it live at PAX East 2015. I have this hypothesis that video games could be so useful in an ethics class, because even in the case of Gone Home, where people derisively just call it a walking simulator, that basic interactivity of just walking around and interacting with objects that relate to a lived character's story does so much more than just, let's say, I am for LGBTQ rights, and we need more than this country. Gay people have made strides. There still is more to be done, and we need to do a whole heck of a lot more for transgender people in this country. Let's say I walk up to somebody who hates all of that and wants rights to be taken away, much less give more rights. If I just walk up to them and say, hello, you need to treat these people like people, treat them like you would treat others, and I have these five bullet points as to why, they're just going to say, oh, screw you, forget this, and they're going to walk away. Nothing is going to happen there. I'm going to say, this is a thing I approve of, they're going to double down on, this is a thing I don't approve of, and we're just going to walk away. Once you interact with a storyline and see somebody as a person, it's much more hard to do that. And there's actually, coming from theological studies, there are many, many cases of people who study congregations, study, groups of religious people. Many Christians coming from cities and states where gay rights are not approved of, and they were told gay people are going to hell. Then they move to a city where gay rights are, gay people have legal rights, gay marriage is allowed, and then they actually meet gay people as people for the first time instead of a political talking point. And then they just can't help but, they can't deny them anymore because they are now a person instead of a political point on a piece of paper or something. And I think games, rather than assigning students a book to read that says, well, you know, biologically and blah, 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 we're all people, like you can't do it for this reason or that reason. I think it would still revert to either they did approve or did not approve beforehand, and they're just going to go back to that position. But when you interact with somebody as a person and realize there's a human being there and there's a story and this is all very meaningful for them, it's hard to deny that. And I think games are a good way of introducing those topics that can be much more impactful than just points on a piece of paper. And Gone Home is my favorite example for that, partially because I think it's effective, partially because it could actually be assigned as homework because it's short.
So you think that a lot of the stereotypes that people suffer from and a lot of the prejudice that they are exhibiting towards others stems from lack of firsthand experience and interaction with the people they are prejudiced against?
It's certainly not the case with everybody, but there are lots of great sociologists who study this stuff in religious communities. And yeah, it's kind of people come to the awareness that, oh, I never actually hated gay people after all. I just kind of never knew it was an option not to. And now that I have actually met them, instead of just being told about them by a straight guy who tells me you can't be gay and nobody can be gay and you must dislike them, well, oh, then I actually met them and they're fantastic. And I actually never thought that being Christian and gay was a problem all along. I was just never in a setting where I knew it was okay. So, yes, I think those sorts of scenarios can play out more effectively with games than with books, because lots of people come to this kind of aha moment where their mind has changed, or they realized this option that was never present to them before because they just interacted with an actual human and their stories. And obviously you're not getting a flesh and bone human in a game, but you're having characters presented as human or as, you know, people with a real story instead of just a talking point. That's why I find Gone Home exciting. Your mention of This War of Mine is fantastic, because that could totally be taught in a class about ethics and war and problems with war and who it actually impacts, you know, the everyday people who have their lives ripped apart, rather than just talking about numbers of soldiers who are died. What about everybody who's left in the aftermath? This War of Mine could be used for very similar reasons.
Any other games that you want to mention that would be included in your syllabus?
What would be included in my syllabus? Do you have ideas? I've not actually had a chance to teach this class. It's all kind of hypothetical, so I haven't sat down and had a whole long list. I guess I'd like to put Life is Strange on there, but in terms of the raw mechanics of assigning it as homework, it's a bit of a longer playthrough, but that would be interesting.
Yeah, there are a lot of games in the past year that I've played that have really focused on the narrative. Life is Strange, Oxenfree, and Firewatch are the three that come to mind, but not all of them are necessarily about empathy. For example, I have a hard time, off the top of my head, seeing how Firewatch or Oxenfree could fit into this class. Life is Strange, I could see, because of the end of chapters 2 and 4, which, actually, maybe it was the beginning of chapter 4. Yeah, it was the end of chapter 2, beginning of chapter 4. And those two moments were some of the finest moments in gaming I've ever experienced, because they made me so uncomfortable. And very few games are able to elicit that reaction from me. I think that it takes a powerful narrative to invoke any emotion in a person, not necessarily a positive emotion like joy or happiness, but even discomfort or horror or anger. I think it takes a really effective storyteller to do that. And those moments in Life is Strange were uncomfortable for me because I didn't know what to do. I was tortured by the idea that my decision was going to have real consequences for the characters in this game. The storytelling had been so effective up to that point that these characters felt real to me, despite some stilted dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And even though obviously I knew they weren't, it still was more meaningful than if it was just a random NPC in a role-playing game.
I think the fact that you say that is kind of what I think is proof, or some proof, of my concept, where discussing ethics issues without, since Life is Strange is still relatively new, I won't even mention the barest minimum of spoilers, but there's certainly ethical issues in there that are also current political topics. The fact that it hit you that way and you were genuinely struggling with it, I think would be so much more interesting than giving students an equation, basically, where it's either this or this. What do you choose? This is what we call ethics. Now let's debate about which is the right choice. That's much less impacting than the interactivity that you get. Because even if you present it to students as you get to choose, which one do you do? But it's just a diagram on a whiteboard. It's not the same, and it doesn't stick the same way as when you're playing in a video game and you've got a few hours of time built up getting to know the character you're actually making the choice about. Because that's how ethics work in the real world. You're not choosing between dots on a whiteboard that technically represent people. It's actual people with lives and stories, and you may know some of them. And that's when ethics gets really muddy, messy, and interesting, and real, rather than just abstract philosophical talk. So I appreciate your comment and take it as proof of my hypothesis.
But at the same time, let's say that timing wasn't an issue, that we were able to assign a lengthier game like Life is Strange to a class and have them play up to the beginning of Chapter 4, for example. Not every player is going to respond the same way I did. I think that maybe playing this game will encourage empathy, but maybe having that severe a reaction in the first place requires some baseline empathy, and some people will get to that point in the game and just say, wow, this is really contrived. They're obviously trying to pull my strings here. These characters are fake. I don't give a rat's patootie. So how do you teach empathy? They've shown that, for example, reading fiction helps because it puts you in the head of other people besides yourself. But at the end of the day, if somebody doesn't care about a video game, playing that game isn't going to make them care.
Yeah, I've actually, it's interesting that we're kind of on Life is Strange right now. Another kind of hypothetical thing I would like to do, I'd really need to refine this idea since it involves actual people in an experiment and that needs to be approved by all sorts of ethics boards and stuff. It would be fascinating to see straight, gay, transgender, bi, queer people play play Life is Strange. And I'm curious what some of their decisions would be, both in Chapter 4 and at the very, very, very end of the game. In the beginning of Chapter 4 and at the very end of the game, I'd be curious to see what decisions they make and if there's overlap between the groups and what they did. And I'm guessing there would be some differences. And as you say, people might not have empathy towards a gay character to begin with, and they say, "Well, you're trying to trick me into liking a gay character, and I don't frankly care, and I'm not going to have any of it." But that's still a more interesting place to have a conversation about why people do think you should care about gay people, more so than, again, just treating them as abstract statistics or people in a diagram in a textbook. I think that's a better place to start the conversation about clearly people are on this side of the issue. Clearly, people are on the other side of the issue. But again, I think it's a better place to start than just the abstraction of a lot of ethics talk, which doesn't realize there's lives and stories involved. So if somebody still says, to heck with all this, I still don't like gay people. I definitely don't like transgender people. I don't even recognize any of your other silly letters, all you people who want me to approve rights of all these people. If they come to that position after having played through a game where somebody is presented with a storyline and as a person rather than just a point on a piece of paper, I think there's a more interesting place to start a conversation. So you're totally right that could happen. And I still think that's a better place to start the talk.
And just because I'm sure one of our listeners will mention it if we don't, have you played Undertale?
I have played I don't know how what percentage of it. I have played it. I have not finished it. I got sidetracked. I kind of know how it all goes. So we can talk about it. I do not know the ending, and I'm not even sure there can be an ending because of the way the game goes. So so that's where I am with Undertale.
Would you include it in your syllabus?
Yeah, interesting. But for empathy reasons, for the mechanic it has going on there. Yeah, that could be interesting. One of the interesting conversations that I had at Game Loop a couple weeks ago, since I already brought that up, was how religion is sometimes a combination of kind of just the mere facts, but also a game mechanic and stuff like Crusader Kings or even the Civilization games, where religion is a mechanic in that, kings existed and they promoted the Christian religion. You have priests spreading the word, and that was actually a thing that happened in the world. Historically, it happened, and it's a mechanic in the game because it's kind of recreating these historical situations. Undertale is, interestingly, now that you brought it up, a combination of it's not presenting a religion or trying to be overtly ethical, but the mechanic itself really could make a point there. So yeah, sure. And it's not that long. Undertale could certainly make the list. Do we want to be spoily about Undertale and say why that would be interesting?
I'd prefer you didn't, because I haven't played it yet.
You've not played it, but you're asking? Do you even know? Do you know why your question makes sense, Ken?
Vaguely. I own the game. I purchased it back in January, the same night I bought Gone Home, and I chose Gone Home, and I never got around to the other one.
The way it lets you resolve combat situations is fascinating throughout the entire game.
You can, I mean, I don't think this is spoilery, but you can talk to people, right?
Yeah, you can fight. One of your options in a classical like JRPG fight situation is talking. You can also fight, you can also talk. So yeah.
Well, that sounds much more realistic and much more diverse. And, so many games, the only answer is to shoot the thing you're facing. And that's disappointing in a narrative sense.
Man, now that you say you haven't, you should definitely, coming from somebody who just said he hasn't beaten the game, you should definitely play the game because it's short. And I should probably go back and beat it myself. But yeah, your question makes more sense than you maybe even realize it did in the context of this conversation, since you hadn't played it.
I'm just that good an interviewer.
Yes.
Actually, if I go to the website howlongtobeat.com, Undertale is estimated as taking, at the minimum, 6.5 hours, at the most, 18 hours for a completionist approach.
I know there's some really wild stuff going on with completing that game. My understanding is that if you're just kind of playing it, it's like, I think it's more like, 5 to 6.
That sounds doable. I should make a point of that some weekend coming up. Well, Ben, we have covered a ton of topics, and they're very in-depth topics. I know that we could talk a lot more about any one of these. I encourage listeners who are interested in these topics to subscribe to TheoNerd, which is found at theonerd.com, where you and your co-host discuss more of these matters in depth far more frequently than Polygamer does. Are there any other links that you'd like to share with our listeners, such as where to find yourself on Twitter?
Yeah, the only thank you for plugging the show. Yeah, it's theonerd.com, and you can just search for TheoNerd on any app that you use to listen to your podcasts. And we're on Facebook and Twitter at TheoNerdcast, and I'm on Twitter at Ben Chica. And that is where, interestingly enough, my Facebook and my social media is split. Facebook is where all of my religious conversations happen, and Twitter is where all of my video game conversations happen, because that's just how the friends happen to go. So if you want to hear me talk about kind of philosophy, theology, but always related to video games, Twitter is where that will happen.
Excellent. Ben, thank you so much for being a friend of the show.
You could just call me a friend, Ken, and drop off the show.
Maybe someday. Thanks again, Ben. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Ken.
This has been Polygamer, a GameBits production. Find more episodes, read our blog, or send feedback at polygamer.net.
one thing we didn't talk about was your Patreon and the fact that I am your only backer.
Oh, did you? Gosh, I need to talk to Andrew. We were talking about nixing the Patreon because we didn't understand how Patreon worked, really, and we thought we were premature with doing it. So yeah, that's a conversation we just started talking about. So.